My phone rang for about a year and a half until we worked through all that. And then I was going to do this till I found a real job. And I started in 2010. And 15 years later, I still haven't found a real job. So I don't know if that makes me successful or lazy, but I'll let your listener or you decide which one it is.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Jeff Haybrook from Lucrum Consulting. Interesting name. We're going to talk about that. And Jeff has a good story to bring to us today about how he was able to identify how a particular customer was able to turn their business from a parts and materials style business into a much more profitable productized business. So we'll get into that a little bit. But before we do, Jeff, maybe you can introduce yourself by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Hi, well, thank you, James. Very nice to meet you and be here with you. Appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, my name is Jeff Haybrook. Lucrum Consulting is here in Charlotte, North Carolina in the States, so a little bit far away from you, but fun fact, you might not know, I'm an Eagle Scout, still active in scouting with my sons and enjoy it very much. I think it's a great organization.
Yeah. My wife is a leader in our scouts. We have Sea Scouts here.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, it's a bit of a labor of love. Like, she looks at some of the other leaders and they're like loving it and they're really drinking the Kool-Aid and they're getting into it. And she's there because her kids are there, you know, but she's like, What am I missing? Like, why do some people really love it? Am I a bad person? Like, she's like, you know, this is, so what makes people want to go and be a, because are you still involved in it? Are you like you a leader in your local group?
Yep, absolutely. But I have two boys in it. So I have one still in Cub Scouts and one in Boy Scouts or Scouting America, whatever it's called now. I'm sorry if I'm not politically correct, but I grew up when it was Boy Scouts. So it's going to be hard to change that habit. So I have double campouts. I am the popcorn coordinator. The Girl Scouts, everybody knows, sells cookies. Boy Scout sells popcorn, so I do that for the Cub Scout pack. And then for the Boy Scout troop, I don't have an assigned role, but I volunteer where I can and do whatever I can. I am a certified assistant scoutmaster, so I'm on the roll, and I enjoy it very much. So I think it's a great organization, teaches good leadership, teaches other skills that kids wouldn't get anywhere. They can always go learn sports and taekwondo and stuff, but not many kids learn how to build fires, tie knots, and go up to an adult and ask the adult to do something for them. And that's something I think really is powerful, that teaches young men and now women to interact with adults in a different way, or people that are, they see as, you know, quote, above them, and not be scared.
So, well, now I'm really tempted to ask you about how a fractional CFO can run the popcorn sales and distribution channel for Scouts of America. I wonder how I'll just ask this. Is your team, are you above average? Is your team above average by happenstance?
We are. Okay. We do pretty well. We hit the highest commission rates and stuff like that. So
it's okay. Shocker.
More about herding cats. It really is just literally three months of a lot of, it's very intensive, and then I do nothing for about 9 months. So it's
very good. Okay, so if you run an Eagle Scout group out there and you're wondering how to improve your popcorn sale numbers, maybe hire a fractional CFO. We can bring one in, so that could help. Okay, so all right, now we have super high standards here on the podcast. We only bring the best of the best on. So we've got to make sure that you're actually qualified to call yourself a fractional CFO. So why don't you give us the rundown of your background and your biggest commercial success so far?
All right. Well, thank you. From a background standpoint, I did 4 years in undergrad, got my degree in accounting, got my CPA certificate, license, whatever term you want to use, passed the exam, that whole thing here in North Carolina. Finished up my master's in accounting at a school in the University of North Carolina system, UNC Charlotte. Did 5 years in public accounting, decided that wasn't for me, the whole work-life balance. Just really got tired of doing taxes and having to learn new rules every year when the government arbitrarily changed them. Then moved to a land development company, really, really enjoyed that. I say unfortunately, just because the way it ended, not because I didn't enjoy the work I did. I love the work I did. I love the team I was with. I might still be there to this day if the recession here in the U.S., the housing recession of 2009 hadn't happened. And we were in residential land development. So we did lot development where you take somebody's farm and turn it into lots and sell those lots to regional or national home builders, then sell that to individual homeowners. And that market just absolutely died in 2009. So left with no revenue coming in. There was no choice, but the partners went their own way. I wrote my own termination letter and I was pretty much unemployed. My phone kept ringing because I had a skill set. Tax and real estate were very in demand at that time because everyone was hurting, and the CPAs to do net operating loss carrybacks needed clean books. So they said, well, you know, we can't help you with that, but this guy can, give him a call. So a little bit of generating work for themselves and also a little bit of helping their clients. My phone rang for about a year and a half until we worked through all that. And then I was going to do this till I found a real job. And I started in 2010, and 15 years later, I still haven't found a real job. So I don't know if that makes me successful or lazy, but I'll let your listener or you decide which one it is.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, when you call yourself a quote unquote entrepreneur, the first year, you have about a year, maybe two, before you're basically unemployable. Like, that's it. Like, yeah, there's no going, you burn the boats and you're right there and you learn how to make it work. So for Agreed. Better or worse.
Agreed.
Okay. So now we were discussing before the show, you've got a very interesting case study. I really like it for a couple of reasons, but you work your typical, I mean, you've got a background there with construction. But this customer service people's gardens, right?
That was landscaping. Yep. So you guys call it the garden, we call it the yard or the lawn. But yep.
So what were they at when they came to you, or what sort of shape was the business in before you got to them? What were they doing, and what were the issue that they were facing?
Yeah, they were definitely a profitable company. They had been in business for a while, had a great reputation, had a lot of high end clients, like in the neighborhoods that they wanted to be in, the up and coming neighborhoods. Here in Charlotte, there's a large lake north of town. So the Lake Norman area is known for its, like a better word, wealth. An area also in just south of town called South Park. There's a lot of high net worth individuals that live there. They had a very large concentration there. So great referrals from landscape architects for people building, you know, $1 million plus homes. $1 million home is not much as it used to be, but we're talking people that be doing, you know, $300,000-$600,000 landscape installs on their $5-6 million home. You know, their boathouse or pool house would cost $1 million attached to their larger house on, you know, people. One of their clients I know bought two lots side by side on the lake, combined them and built one house on the two lots. So those are the kind of clientele that they worked for. So they were very successful in what they did, but in terms of the landscaping side, but they also did tree work for common folks like me and you. They would come out and remove a tree or prune a tree or fertilize a tree. So they really had a nice, successful business that they built from the ground up. Two guys that were elementary school friends, and had really built a successful business, but just didn't have that financial background, and got to a point where they and some of their advisors realized they needed a higher level advice and higher level financial solution. And we were lucky enough to get the call and hit it off and had a great relationship with them.
Okay. And what sort of billings were they doing, and how were they billing, more importantly? Like, how were they, you know, quoting up jobs, and what sort of level of revenue had they got to by the time you got to them?
Yeah. So if memory serves, I think they were in the 3-3.5 range. It really depended on the service line that you were talking. If you called them out for tree work, they'd send someone out to do the quote. And that was kind of the quote, unless you changed the scope of work. The same really with the landscape install, where they, you know, would get the plans from the landscape architect and the builder and work directly with the builder to do that, or with someone who had already moved into their house that had engaged a landscape architect and sent the plans out that way. So those were kind of already set. I didn't really see an opportunity there, and I really didn't see much opportunity with the third one that we're talking about today until I got into the business and was really working with them to try and improve the profitability of it. And through, you know, various conversations, a couple years in, we had obviously a lot more low-hanging fruit to work on first. Budgeting, forecasting, more accurate financials, better processes, then I start going in to change their actual business model. But it evolved into that after I built up some trust and some rapport with them. About the second or third year is when we actually got the opportunity to work on this project, which is the landscape maintenance side, where they would go out and do the actual maintenance on the lawns or garden, to use your parlance.
So this part of it, from a business perspective, although it might not be as fancy a big ticket as the, you know, the install, I guess, but the hallowed recurring revenue element of the maintenance contracts really is where there's an opportunity, right? You get a chance to build up enterprise value in your business, not just, you know, smoke in a bottle, let's call it. So, and how were they quoting for that maintenance contract? You know, what was working with it, I guess, and what wasn't working?
Absolutely. Well, go back to one aside. At one point, they discussed shutting it down, and I was vehemently against that because they would do the install, and then somebody said, well, who can maintain it? And if you couldn't maintain it, you had a lot less chance of getting selected to do the initial install. And also, I liked the fact that the trucks, the maintenance trucks, were in those neighborhoods that they wanted to be in on a regular basis. So when you're walking your dog or you're, you know, looking out your front window, you'll see their truck across the street servicing your neighbor's lawn. Who are you going to call for tree work or landscape install or to get your lawn maintained? So I thought it was a great marketing, and I encouraged them to keep it, keep the line of business as a marketing thing. We just figured out how to make it profitable. Even if it was somewhat of a loss leader or slightly below margin, it was an undeniable marketing benefit. So going back to your question, James, the way they were quoting was really a la carte for everything. What do you want? Here's the menu of services and you pick what you want. It wasn't more of a commoditized thing. A lot of the stuff was done bare bones, meaning you just did the mow, blow, and go, but then everything else was as needed, as requested, as approved. So it required a lot of time, billing, a lot of communication between the staff. And that was one of the problems, that they had a lot of questions. The staff would ask the supervisor or the guy that ran that department, what do we do with this client? What do we do this week? What do we do, you know, next week, kind of thing? Or they would do something they thought they were supposed to do, but it wasn't agreed to ahead of time. So they end up having to just eat it and not able to charge the client for it because it wasn't approved. Again, due to a communication faults and lag time.
I guess that makes sense because they came from that world where everything was spec'd out and, yeah, you know, you're working with an architect and that's just the way you worked. And you just take that model and you bring it over, you try and run a different business using the same model because that's been successful over there. It must be how we do it here. But what was your concept of how they could change things?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right too. That's exactly how it happened. They didn't go in the business with landscape and then start doing install and tree work. They each went in with their own disciplines, the two owners. One was a tree background guru and the other one was a landscape install guy. They moved into the maintenance side as a recurring revenue kind of thing to kind of make their business more valuable and more desirable. So you're exactly right. My idea, I think that's the question you asked, was to more commoditize it and more systematize it so we didn't have so many exceptions. We didn't have a different plan for everyone. What really was the catalyst or the light bulb went on in my head was the manager of that department was complaining in a good way, but just complaining about how busy he was every month just handling renewals at a particularly busy time. You know, when over here, when the grass grows is spring and fall. It's too hot in the summer and it doesn't grow in the winter. So unfortunately, he was dealing with renewals 12 months out of the year. So I said, well, why don't we make all the renewals happen at one time? And he's like, oh, we'd have to do it. And it's just kind of peeling back the onion. We opened up all these problems and saw all this frustration, how it just wasn't working. And it was really swamping his bandwidth and consuming way too much time. And frankly, we were leaving a lot of money on the table, which was evident in the low profitability of that division, which is why the owners wanted to cut it originally.
Interesting. So they were leaving money on the table because they were just, the billing was so complex, they weren't billing the right people. They were overbilling some people, underbilling people. It wasn't basically, it was kind of chaos.
I don't think they were overbilling people. That's a bad problem. That's a good problem to have, but it's still a problem. But no, I think like a lot of home builders deal with change orders. If they don't have a good process to do with the change order, if you and your wife are building a house and you upgrade the granite from grade one to grade three, you know the grade three granite got installed. It's whether the builder remembered to bill you the additional cost for that, which is 100% profit at that point because they've already paid for the material. That's the same thing here. They already put the fertilizer or the pesticide treatment on your lawn. Did they remember to bill you for it after the fact? So I think there's a lot of forgotten to bill or underbilling.
Okay. So the billing, I understand. You wrote all the customers saying, hey, we've got a new... great news. We're billing you all at the same time. You're just going to get one bill in January and that's going to be it. Maybe you had to give some discounts or something. I don't know. But did you get any pushback, by the way, when you sent out those emails or newsletters or letters?
Well, what we did, I think we might be jumping ahead a little bit. What we did is we changed the whole process. So first off, we did renewals all on February 1st. February 1st. So everything renewed February, which is a very slow time in that business. So it's perfect.
Nice.
You've gotten through the year end, anything there, and we have time to do it because the grass hasn't really started growing yet. We're March 5th or 6th here, and I haven't mowed my lawn once yet this year, so that's great. Also, too, we systematized it a lot more. There are two types of turf that are real common in our area, Bermuda and fescue. Well, they have different maintenance requirements. They have different growing rates. They have different fertilizer needs. So that was something that was clear from my interview and conversations with them. We had to bifurcate any services we offered was, are you a fescue lawn or a Bermuda lawn? But then from there, a lot of it was able to be systematized. So we came up with five services that we're going to offer to everybody. Turf care, which is actually mow, blow, and go. Turf treatment, fertilizing, weeds, fungicides, stuff like that. Plant and shrub care, so taking care of pruning, removals, fertilizing the plants, fall services, aerating, seeding, renovating the lawn, and a very minor, not a full renovation, but minor renovation, kind of the normal maintenance side of thing, and then tending the irrigation. And that was the package. And if you didn't have an irrigation system, then it was still included in the package, but that was the price. And it took some of the variables out. All we needed to know is what kind of turf do you have and how many square feet of turf do you have? Those two variables, we could give you a quote. So that became something we're having to go on site to do an in-depth quote. They could do most of it from Google Earth and just go put eyes on it to verify what they saw was accurate.
Nice. And there are two types of turf here. So was there a pricing difference between them, depending on what people chose? Or
there was a little bit. The Bermuda requires a lot less care and maintenance, and it's a lot less finicky. Most people say it doesn't look as pretty, but again, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And a lot of people say, oh, for the less I have to spend on the fescue, I'll deal with a little bit of ugliness with the Bermuda. So,
right. Okay. Cool. And then, so financially then, did you have to give up on the, because I guess the custom quote thing, you think you'd maximize the price a bit better if you're custom quoting people and, you know, you look at the type of car they're driving and maybe adjust your quote a little bit according to that. So, or did the revenue turn out to be the same, now that everyone's getting the same price?
Well, no, everyone didn't get the same price, because if you have, let's just say, a half acre and I have 3/4 acre, my price would be more, unless we just happen to have the same amount of turf. But assuming we had a different amount of turf, our price would be different. The revenue and the profitability of the department actually went up because we weren't missing out on all those extra charges. A lot of the stuff that we'd been billing for ad hoc, a la carte, was now included. The extra stuff still had to be billed because maybe you have a fire ant problem. They're a big thing here. It's a very painful ant. They build ugly mounds in your yard, and if you're kid or your dog gets in them, they'll just eat you alive. They're a terrible thing. They're out of Brazil. So it's slowly creeping north here in the States. I doubt they have them where you are. It's probably too cold, but that would be an add-on treatment that some people might not need it. Some people wanted us to do it, or they might have their pest guy. Maybe somebody else would do it. Their termite treatment or their spider treatment every quarter might take care of their fire ant problem. Different difficult weeds, mulching, major turf renovation, doing tree care, all that stuff was still a la carte. So we didn't give away the farm. We just really tried to systematize the stuff that 90 or 80% of our clients use on a regular basis.
Okay. And there, like you say, there's some parts that couldn't be. So you told me about these army worms as well. Like you get attacked by army worms.
And then those are bad too. They kind of get pushed in from more of the southern area, like a hurricane will push them in. And they'll just decimate a fescue lawn in no time. And then you have to go, one, you have to kill them or they eat the whole lawn. And you have like 24 hours to get to them because they're voracious. If you've heard about the plague of locusts back in the biblical times, just think of that. They don't block out the sun, but you know it's akin to that from what I understand.
I was going to say, it's sounding pretty biblical out there. You know, we had St. Patrick get rid of all our snakes, so we don't have all these things. And we moved up from South Africa, and so my kids are, you know, there's all sorts of things that'll eat you down there. So mostly humans, but anyway, but my kids, now that we're here, they're like, oh, that's great. I can go outside. I don't have to worry about any spiders or anything. Like, they're like, ah, you call that an animal? That's not an animal. You know, like,
Well, I'm sure they called for divine intervention a few times, but I don't know if it was in the religious way. So we'll let that
by. Yeah, no, but that's very good. Okay, so I mean, we can learn from this. I mean, I'm experiencing this a little bit in my own business. We sell software, you know, but we do this reporting product, you know, which is basically custom reporting, and we've kind of gone the other way where we have our custom software, people pay monthly, but the reporting can kind of grow arms and legs. People want to change their reporting. They want different formats and stuff. And I've started switching people over to hourly rates for consultancy on the reporting. And then I put everyone else in the, you know, the subscription revenue part of it. So there's a lesson here for business. I think not all, you know, not everything is good for a subscription. Not everything's good to be productized, and vice versa. It can hurt you if you get the match wrong either way, I guess. So now what I'm interested, we alluded to, because this type of business I know is hot with private equity at the moment, and it really helps with your valuations in terms of, has this business had a look at that? Do you think it's, if you had to guess, has it changed the valuation, the enterprise value of this business? And if you had to guess, what the impact would, what do you think it has been?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a valuation guru, and we didn't really consult a business broker before and after the changes. And plus there's other variables in the business. So maybe if this was going up, maybe another side of the business might've been struggling a little bit. And it was also a small percentage of the business. It was about 20% of the overall revenue. And again, on the lower end of the profit too, of the three, they really had four, but let's just say three big lines of business or departments, divisions, whatever term you want to use. This was by far the lowest profit margin, but it was also the lowest investment required, had the lowest number of people, had the lowest cost. You could outfit a whole rig, whole truck and everything for $75,000, $1,000 US dollars. So that's the cost of less than one piece of equipment for the other sides of the business.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay. So, and then there's this, there's a synergy there by the sounds of it, the end, the advertising value, and I like it.
I will say, based on hindsight, that you mentioned private equity, I was kind of chuckling because they did eventually sell, which ended my tenure with this company shortly after this exercise, to a private equity firm that was doing a large roll-up of these type of businesses all along the East Coast. And one of the things that they were attracted to in buying my former client was the fact that they had the maintenance side and the recurring revenue piece to that. And it wasn't all project work or when the phone rings, we'll come take care of your tree type work. So Don't want to take credit for it. They already had the business before I got there, but I'd like to think I helped by making it more efficient. And we could definitely show that we increased the profitability of this line that we worked on. That was
You know what? If it hadn't gone well, they'd probably blame you. So you might as well take the credit when it's gone well for them. That's you're allowed to do that.
And we're still friends. They've sold a year and a half ago, and we're still friends to this day. So
interesting. Yeah.
We're still talking.
Can I ask you about you were there for the sales process?
I was.
Yeah. And, you know, my impression is, you know, private equity are buying people all the time. It's like another day at the office, but it's been quite stressful if you're on the other side of the transaction. How is this for the owners? And obviously you were integral to this process. So how was that experience of being acquired by the private equity firm?
It went pretty smoothly. I give a credit to my former clients. They were never greedy, as in squeeze every dime they can out of it. They were looking more for the right partner. I think they went in with the right approach. And I don't mean that in a judgmental kind of way, but they had the right mindset. And it wasn't, you know, we're going to get rich on this. We're going to do well. We're going to take care of our people. We're going to find the right partner. There's a trade-off. I mean, we're coming off a lot of guarantees, and we don't have to deal with all the headaches and stuff that we've been dealing with for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. So they understood some of that, where I think a lot of people, when we see it, it's like, this is my opportunity to cash out and I can go play golf or fish or, you know, buy that house in the mountains that I've been wanting to and put money away for college and have enough for retirement. So when you start adding all that together, it becomes a different purpose. And these two guys never really had that. So, you know, I don't want to be judgmental and saying they had the right way or the wrong way, but it was really, it made it a much more pleasant opportunity. And the due diligence process went well. They never go smooth, but they always, some can go very badly and some can go just a little bit badly. And this one was definitely more on the little bit badly side, which is about as best you can get, right? It's kind of like getting a root canal. It wasn't terrible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, in that situation, the buyer is incentivized to find problems, right? Of course, it must be a terrifying thing to take on a business. You don't know where the bodies are.
Yep.
So it's kind of it's a rite of passage. You know, like if your business can survive that, then you have your ducks in a row. Okay. So let me ask you a little bit about your own practice then here. Is this a good example of the type of customers you like to work with, or is there an archetype or?
Absolutely. It's just a great one. It was a great relationship. I had a lot of fun. I used to look forward to working. You never want to pick, you know, which client's your favorite, just like you wouldn't say which kid is your favorite. But if I had to pick, you know, the three, if I had to give three, this would definitely be one of my top three. I have another one. That's another client that I've worked with, actually one of my first recurring clients. Been working with this gentleman since 2011. We helped him grow from the low 3 million range, and their budget this year is 25 million. So very excited to be part of that team for such a long run. I mean, almost 14 years. That's a pretty long time for a consultant to be working with the same firm and a pretty wide growth rate. Our sweet spot is in the 2 to 25 million in revenue and 5 to 50 employees. We can go outside of there for sure. We had one client that had 18 different franchise locations. He had about 300 folks working for him throughout all the entire system. But I only worked with about 3 or 4 people in the office. He had just a real small overhead. That was just a lot of the people that actually did the work. So we have other folks that have, you know, exited their business, done very well, and they have a team of one, and that we provide CFO services to them, you know, more of like the investor, private developer kind of person that just knows the value from his previous business of having high level financial advice and good quality bookkeeping. So that can be a good fit. But those are more of the outliers. I'd say that 2 to 25 revenue, 5 to 50 employees is a really good target. And definitely in the contracting, home building, subcontractor, and service type businesses is where we like to play the most.
Okay. And at the top of the show, I commented on the name, Lucram Consulting. So I didn't know where it came from. So how'd you come up with the name? Because it's slightly unusual.
I mentioned I was in home building and land development. And 2009, I had a lot of free time. So I could see the writing on the wall and was just trying to find a name that was cool. I definitely didn't want to be Jeff Haybrook Consulting or anything like that. Don't have an ego. So I was looking for a name and was just doing Google Translate. I've always been a fan of Latin, love Roman history. I took Latin in high school and just was typing in words and seeing what it is and came up with lucrum, which is the derivation of the word lucrative, financial gain, profit. So if you made a lot of lucrum in Latin, you made a lot of profit. You had a lot of financial gain back in the day. I'm sure I'm using that term correctly. My high school English teacher, or sorry, high school Latin teacher would give me an F. But
very good. I was about to say, you were obviously educated in the 1800s. I didn't know they were still teaching Latin then. But you look way too young to be learning Latin. But
I did go to Catholic school, so that Catholic high school. So there was a little bit of an incentive to do that.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, listen, this has been super interesting. You gave me inspiration. And sometimes my kids test me and ask me, you know, which of my two kids is their favorite. Now I'm going to tell them, well, you're definitely in the top three.
Yeah, a neighbor down the street's got a pretty good run on you.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. And thank you for listening. If you got this far into the show, your special reward is if you're a fractional CFO like Jeff, you can come along to our CFO Mastermind that happened monthly last Wednesday of every month. I think Jeff might have come to the last one. I'm not sure. But
wasn't able to make it, but I have it on my calendar next month.
Okay, great. Yeah. So how it works is you come along, we put you in a group with three or four other fractional CFOs. Bring your favorite business problem that you're working on. It could be your practice development. It could be to do with a client issue. And you get feedback from peers who are working in the same sphere that you are. Some of them are two steps behind. Some of them are a few steps ahead. It's a good chance to network, meet with your peers. And it's been a lot of success. So you can sign up for that at procurementexpress.com/CFO Mastermind. All right, Jeff, thanks very much for being on the show. It's been a good one.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for the opportunity.